I'm Michelle Orman, and this is the Couture Podcast. A self-proclaimed garage designer, for the past 17 plus years, artist Jules Bryant has been helping women feel empowered through her designs, her mentorship, and her advocacy. Jules has faced and overcome a lot of adversity in her life, and she's learned countless lessons along the way, looking at the challenges she's encountered as opportunities to enrich her character. Jules and I sat down together, remotely, while social distancing due to the coronavirus, to discuss how she's faring amidst the current challenges we're collectively facing. While she is experiencing the same fears and uncertainty that we're all feeling, her staunch determination to continue to run her business with the same value system she's always embraced is nothing short of inspiring. She also sees this as an opportunity to uplift, elevate, and support others in our community. And she's looking forward to the eventual opening of her new multi-brand gallery in Solana Beach, California, which was originally slated to open in mid-March. Jules Bryant's spirit is absolutely radiant, and I will forever be grateful to her for reminding me to pause and find joy in the moments because, as she reminds us, we don't get this time back. This is the moment. I am here today with Jules Bryant, not actually here in the same room, but it's lovely to see you via Skype, Jules. How are you?
Good. I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. So how is everyone in your world right now in the midst of this kind of scary time?
You know, there are like ebbs and curves. I think, you know, one minute you feel a certain way. It's not even day by day. I think it's like hour by hour how people feel and what people are going through and how everybody absorbs this. Because, you know, I think even in the world, no one really understands this. So how could us, you know, understand if that's not our specialty, we're not in the CDC and we're not, you know, physician, et cetera. But I would say my personal perspective is that my team and my family thus far are taking it like one day at a time. And every person around me has had a day that has been not their day, you know, and I think that's true. And then you reset and you pick yourself back up and you pull your bootstraps up and you go another moment. And I think that's really what life is about, is a series of those moments. And this just happens to be one of them.
It's true. And I've come to the place where, of course, I've had hard days and people around me have had hard days, but, you know, ultimately I just say, you know, there's only so much you can control. And, you know, that is staying inside and washing my hands and staying safe and healthy and, you know, ensuring that the people around me do as well. And beyond that, none of us, you know, none of us now.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I'm in a lot of people think I'm in LA. I'm not, because people say, oh, Jules is from LA. I'm actually from a small beach town, actually.
Oceanside, right?
Yeah. And it's next to Carlsbad, which a lot of people know the GIA in our industry. So it's a little different than if you're in a congested area where people are, they feed off each other, you know, and you yourself know you're in New York City where it's been hit the hardest, you know, and Brooklyn and in, where people are on top of each other. So the way that like we in our community deal with things, I think it's been a longer time for people to really accept that. Because if it's like sunny out today, it isn't sunny actually, but if it's sunny out, people naturally want to go surf. They want to walk outside. It's a feeling of things must be okay because like the sun is giving us warmth, you know? And so we have that all the time, most of the time. And so people are finally, it can be eerie when you're in a community where generally people are outside and there's not as many people out, you know?
So, well, we'll go back into a little bit more of sort of, I guess, the positive of what, you know, what's coming out of this for you as a creative, but, I want to back up a little bit and I'd love to hear a little bit more about your childhood, you know, kind of what kind of a kid were you growing up?
I was weird. I'll be honest with you. I was like a weird kid.
My favorite people are.
And you know, I was raised by a mom who was a farmer's daughter and gorgeous. and a dad who came from like upper middle class. They were married and divorced when I was 5. And so my mother took my sister and I and moved us to California. We were from Oregon. And so this like perfect life that we had in a square box was obviously vastly different when that happened. And I just always did things my own way. Like my mom was one of those, she was like, you know, always look beautiful, hair dialed, nails perfectly done, everything. And, you know, the fork went in this slot in the night. And I was the kid that just threw her for a loop, you know, never put the fork in the slot it was supposed to go in. Knife went in this slot. And I, you know, just was danced to my own drum. And so my mom, when I was 5, she said, I came home from my first day of school and I was like banging my head against the wall. And I mean, she was traumatized. So I actually was diagnosed with ADD before they called it that. It was called minimal brain dysfunction, actually. And wow. I was up in record books. Yeah. Like, you know, historically, whatever. And so she tried everything. Like what, how am I going to keep this kid like, you know, focused or what have you. So she tried art class and she said to the art teacher, I was like, Mrs. Loveberg was her name. She said, now she won't sit longer than 30 minutes. So I'll just sit out in the parking lot and I'll just check in after 30 minutes. And I was apparently fixated and I could not. And after 3 hours, she drug me out of there. And that's what started my, I think, real love and need to be creative. And I mean, you know, on the one hand, as a child where, you know, you didn't fit into what my mom thought I should be perfectly. And I was kind of awkward and not an attractive child at all. And I had an older sister.
I find that hard to believe. You're stunning.
Oh, thank you. I wasn't, but thank you. And so my mom really revered beauty, you know. And so, but she did understand, I think, enough. I'm 51. So she understood enough that, like, if I can find something for her that she loves, then that will actually keep her motivated. And I was smart. So it was like smart and ADD was a disaster for my mom. But, you know, I thank her every day because my mother passed away 2 years ago almost now. And I really appreciate her teaching me how to become organized and how to like have a strong value system and a moral ethic. And that combined with like my need to be art, I'm really a left, right brain person. And people have said that to me constantly. Like, how do you have such a good business background? And then you're artistic. And I was like, my mom, it was like going through like, what is it? Like a camp of like, you do this and do it like that. Mm-hmm. And so I learned for that.
But you originally started doing software engineering or working at a software engineer company?
So I actually worked. A lot of people don't know this about me either, so I'll share this. I guess I'm out in the public forum now, right? So I moved out at a very young age, and I needed to do that because my mom was going through some challenging times. And so I figured if I work really hard, then I can keep a roof over my head and all those kinds of things. So I actually didn't graduate from high school. Wow. And, yep. And I just had an incredible drive and passion, and I didn't go to college, and I taught myself, and I got into jobs that I should never have been in, put it that way. And so my career started, I got a job when I was 18 at Nordstrom. I mean, I had worked for years before, but I got a job at Nordstrom as a stock girl, and I had no money. And I asked for this position as a salesperson, and the girl told me, you don't have the right clothes, so you can't have the job. And so I had a little bit of savings, and I went to Marshall's, and I bought an outfit that kind of looked like they would have worn at Nordstrom. And the next day I came in with pantyhose on, and I said, well, now I'd like to apply. And she said, the position's filled. So I went down to the jewelry department, and they had a temp position that I would be giving up my regular full-time position as a stock person, but get the temp position in the jewelry department. And I took it. I took the risk. And I volunteered during that time at a United Way event because I figured I need to get noticed. How am I going to grow? And I ended up having higher sales than the pace setter, who's like the top salesperson during that 2-week period. And they offered me a regular full-time position. And as I was going up the escalator to get my personal book, which was kind of a rite of passage back then, and Jim Nordstrom was my boss. the HR, the VP of HR was coming down the escalator. Now, mind you, I'm an 18-year-old young girl. I don't know anything. And she's coming down the escalator to come see me. And she goes, oh, can I see you in my office? And I thought, okay, I don't even know what HR is. And I went in there and she goes, we really liked you. And we have this position available in HR. We'd like to offer you the position. So now I had two positions in the same day offered to me. And I took the job. So that started my career in human resources, actually. And my career grew. I was 18 and I grew. And I ended up being like HR training director for Southern California for Nike. And then I got recruited and recruited and recruited. And so then I, towards when I got into video gaming, I got recruited. And I helped build this company from 40 people to 180 at the time of acquisition. And I got very involved with working with chairs of all the math and science and physics departments around the world. So Oxford, Cambridge, Carnegie Mellon, we were the first employer to really get involved in their ETC program. So very involved in that, helping develop like curriculum for people to be able to write code for these very, very elaborate physics games that the hardware existed, but the software engineers weren't as advanced as they needed to be. So, so it was very interesting. So that's how my career happened before I started this.
And then how did you come to, I mean, that's incredible. I mean, talk about chutzpah. I was going to say right place at the right time, but you know, with a lot of chutzpah on top of it. And I really want to know what that outfit was that you got from Marshalls, by the way. But how did you turn towards jewelry design? It sounds like you were on, you know, that creativity was sort of a saving grace as a child. And then because of circumstances, you know, you went into this, you know, HR career and, you know, kind of more corporate and less creative. So what brought you back to that core of your creativity?
Well, a friend of mine actually had passed away. Let me back up. He had cancer. He got better. During the time he was better, he met this girl and fell in love. And it came back like a vengeance, unfortunately. And so they decided to get married. They lived in Denver, but his doctor's office was, or his, sorry, treatment center was in UCLA. And they decided to hurry up their wedding and they took him off chemo for a week or so, just so he'd feel strong for the wedding. And this was at the Brown Palace in Denver. And that night he ended up being life-flighted back to UCLA. So he made it through the wedding part. And they flew him back to UCLA and with his brand new wife, and they didn't know anyone. And the doctors basically said the cancer's everywhere. He won't make it back to Denver. He'll either go to a turnkey apartment or die in the hospital. So now his wife didn't know anyone in LA. So I went up to help her and kind of was a support system to them, you know, and he did live for two more months, but it was pretty rough. And right before he passed, he bought me a bracelet with a little charm on it. And the bracelet pulled my clothing. And so I took the little charm off and went to a bead shop. And I bought these crystals. This is 20 years ago. And I put the little charm on this necklace. And a shop owner in my hometown, I was just walking down the street on Cedros, which is where we're opening our new gallery, which is kind of serendipitous. And a shop owner said, where did you get that? And I said, I made it. And she said, oh my gosh, can I see more? And I was like, I don't do more. But she called a couple days later and said, I really want to see, like, I love that. So my grandmother, who was a really huge inspiration in my life, like incredible woman, farmer, and like had all these beads, and I broke them all apart and I made 20 necklaces wrapped in paper towels in a shoebox and the store bought them. So I was doing this at night as a hobby while I had my career job, which I loved. I loved what I did for a living. I have to say, I love the company I worked for. I was at the height of my career. And this, I was working till 2 a.m. doing this, now this little underground following in my hometown. And mind you, 20 years ago, artisan fine jewelry or artisan jewelry was just starting. It was barely. So our company was 2 years after this, our company was being acquired by Rockstar Games. I don't know if you know.
Yeah, Brad of course Scott. I know Rockstar. Yeah.
So they offered me an international position and their value system was a little different to the value system of our organization, which was, by the way, one of the best companies that I've ever been involved with. And So when they offered me the position, I knew they needed me through the due diligence. And I said, you know, I'm going to take a week off and I'm going to pretend like I'm doing jewelry full time. And I did. And I got up every morning and I had a I did a little private show in my neighborhood. And it was like December, the first week of December. And I called my dad. I said, Daddy, you're not going to believe this. I said, I just sold $4,000 at a show. And he's like, well, it's Christmas. Everybody buys presents. And I was like, no, everyone was their own sugar daddy, which was our tagline for be your own sugar daddy for many years. And so I thought, you know what, this is an opportunity for me to give it a shot. So I went to the company and I said, look, you guys need me through the due diligence. I'll stay on board for 6 months, but I want 6 months of severance. And they agreed to it because they needed me. And I figured that would I'll stay out of the industry for 6 months. I won't be forgotten. If this doesn't work, I'll go back and we'll see what can happen. Because at that point, I'd been like the chair of a salary survey board. All these universities around the world knew about me and stuff. So long story short, that was, we're almost at 17 years now.
You never looked back.
Never looked back. Yeah.
Well, in your acceptance speech for the People's Choice Award that you won at Couture in 2018, which, by the way, I recently rewatched in preparation of this interview, and literally every time it makes me cry. So you referred to yourself as a garage designer. So, you know, can you take me through that? Like, what does that mean?
Well, I always say every good business starts in the garage, and I did for many years because it was, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I did not come from a jewelry background. I knew absolutely nothing. Like, I didn't even know a jewelry supply store existed until a year I'd been doing this. I used the hammer in the toolbox.
Oh, my God.
So it was one of, I literally, in actuality, I was a garage designer. And also the work that I do, I've never felt, it's weird because we've never been in a lane ever. And that's very indicative of who I am. I mean, early on, you know, it used to be years ago, it was only 18. That was only considered fine. And in the beginning, I did like rose gold and sterling blackened, and very few people, they were like, what is that? You know? And so we've never kind of had a lane. And so I've always felt kind of undercover, and I've always tried to do it without riding on anybody else's coattails, you know, and keeping it really simple and trying to be as modest and maintain good values through it. And so sometimes that forces you to have like a lower overhead, to sort of not go with, follow the masses, if you will, you know, because I'm not in Los Angeles and I'm not in New York City. I just kind of have always been undercover here. And I think that sort of determines my design as well. And then because when I started, I live in this community that the GIA didn't even exist, and I had children and I was a single parent, that I was forced to have to make my own jewelry here. I didn't have anywhere to farm it out. And that's what created, I think, our color of gold. I think the finishes, because I literally didn't know what I was doing. So I was like, well, if I can't make it shiny, I'll just make it a little more,
Did that with, didn't you first do that with a knife in your kitchen?
Yeah. Oh, I still use knife in the kitchen. Believe me. I still am like, I can do that. Yeah. So I did it with the hammer in the toolbox and the knife in the kitchen, because I thought, and I had no other influence, you see, because Instagram didn't exist then. You know, there were only print magazines, and I'd never been in jewelry. So I just didn't know that I shouldn't do it that way. And so I say my success and my failures are because I didn't know. I still don't know. You know, I still don't know. But what I can say is that it's been a truly a gift, the fact that I don't know as much, because it just allows me to quiet the noise and go in the garage sometimes, or it feels like that now. And actually, because of COVID, we're going back into the garage, the manufacturing part, and just make what we do and be okay with it. Like, we hand carve, hand cut, hand roll. Do you know, I didn't even have a rolling mill until 3 years ago. Every single piece was hand hammered. Because I bought used benches, and I used those same benches for 16 years, because if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You learn important to be modest and that you can do a lot. That's why during times like this, I feel like the human spirit always prevails. I have such a fire inside of me right now that like anybody around me, I'm like, do not give up. We will be better than we were before. I know we will, 100%.
Yeah, I'm with you there. And I do feel like, I mean, historically, some of the most amazing art in literature and scientific discoveries in the world have happened during quarantine. You know, I mean, that's just a fact. So when I'm having some of my dark moments, I picture artists like you, other couture designers, you know, other artists that I know, and I just like know you're having your moment and can't wait to see what, you know, what results, you know, what the results are. So that brings me to, you know, what's your creative process?
I put pen to paper every day. I sketch and draw every day of my life and it's everywhere. It could be on a notebook. It could be on a coaster. It could be on a piece of paper. I mean, there's times when I come into my staff and I was like, let's make this. And it's literally on a napkin that I've sketched, you know, and I shove it in my pocket. And I mean, and this is the truth. I can show you, you know, multitudes of even in my, this is what I do all day long.
Wow. So it's a big sketchbook with like ring designs and renderings.
I have, they're everywhere, you know, or just
if I'm doodling. Look at that. Is that a peacock?
I don't know. Some kind of, yes. So.
Oh, wow. That's stunning. That's so cool.
So I personally feel that I have I'm very fortunate in that I came onto the scene, like I said, before CAD was really a big thing or before any of that. So you really had to find it inside of you down deep in your soul to create. And you had to look outside your four walls to find inspiration. And that's what I do. And my husband and I made it, he was in music before, and we made a deal that, cause when my son was going to go away to college, I really wanted to move into a city like New York City or what have you. And he was in music and was on tour and he wanted no part of that. And so we made a deal. So we bought a house down in this little cottage down in this town called Oceanside, which used to not be a great town, and it's gentrifying. And every day I get up and I walk in this town and I walk the alleyways and I walk everywhere and I see new life and new interesting things and young people coming in to make restaurants. And I see flowers blooming and I pay attention to these things. And these are the things that inspire me 100%. And then I come back, I was with Wade and we were in San Francisco and he'll, if you ever asked him, he'd probably say this. We were walking down the street from a show and I stopped and on the sidewalk, there was like this pattern in the, I go, look at that cool pattern. And I like took a picture of it and just, and then lo and behold, like, I don't know how it came out, but sort of that pattern in my recent work has come out, this hand etching kind of architectural, which our work is kind of architectural. Like it's the perfect dichotomy of like organic and rigid at the same time, you know? So these are the things that I pay attention to. Of even I could be like watching, say, a commercial or something, and there's like a pattern in the shirt of something that I see. And I was like, oh, that's kind of a cool pattern, you know? I do get most inspired, I will tell you, when I'm having a massage. I don't know why that is. I go to this weird.
Like, oh my God, me too. No, just kidding.
Like my brain is like thinking of all these cool like patterns and ideas and business things because I love business also. So that's actually how we do it. So once when I'm sketching and when I find that I'm doing something over and over again, I'll start with a piece and that's what forms a new collection for me, you know, or a new finish or a new something. If I don't have enough time on this earth to do the things that I want to do, honestly.
Yeah. So how do you decide what goes into production then?
Well, that's where the business side comes in. And that's where you have to be able to show restraint. I think any good business person knows to show restraint and to pause. And to understand that while I could probably sell each piece, that doesn't necessarily mean it's a collection. So once I see that, like I'll do it as like, I kind of do it the way we did it in gaming. Like in gaming, we would do like, we do three levels of a game and just see what, how we felt we could handle it and how like we liked working with the publisher. So I might put out there in the world, like three or four pieces and see what response I have. And then from that response, I'll form a collection. My collection is very interesting because we call it the essentials. Our essentials pieces are still our very best selling pieces. So even though I might create a new collection, they still go back to the number one ring, which is the first ring I ever designed 17 years ago.
And it's called number one.
I call it the number one ring. So NO.1. Yeah. So it's, and the reason it's NO.1 is because I use a 4-letter naming convention. And that's again, the business side of me.
Okay.
So that's what forms and starts like, a collection starting to bloom. And then the hardest part for me is editing, you know?
Yeah. Cause they're all your babies. You love them all.
They're your babies. Oh my God. Well, I don't love them all, but I, or I look back and I think, oh my gosh, did I actually make that? And that was not, but again, remember I'm a garage designer and I'm a scrap cooker. And I can live on very little. So what actually helped me build my business was, okay, the dog tag did well. I'll do that in three sizes. Oh, now I can do the same mold because I don't have to carve something new and we'll just do a different pattern. Mm-hmm. And oh, that cell, I'll just take the stones out of that and then I'll use that gold. And I would just squirrel these little nuts and I would rework, or I'd take like the, if I cut out, because remember we roll everything out. So if I cut out the edge, let's say of something like this, those little corners I turned into pieces.
Ah.
And hand etched those pieces because no waste, right? I didn't want to have any waste. So it really, it kind of helped my business grow, you know, and I still do that to this day. You know, I'm constantly digging through little odds and ends and bits and bobs of things. And I'm like, oh, let's turn that into a chain hanging off the thing. And
that's very cool. Very cool. Well, so I know, you know, starting with, and what was your friend's name who gave you the charm?
Herman.
Nice. I love a good old timey name like that.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, I know that you know, you also mentioned that your mother passed, you know, right before the 2018 show for Couture, Herman. And I know also you're a cancer survivor.
Yes. Yes,
so,
I am.
You know, you've clearly faced a lot of adversity in your life. So in what way, if any, do you feel like that has fueled your creativity? You know, kind of what lessons from your experience with that? You know, you said, somewhere that, you know, breast cancer is a language you speak when you can't communicate. You know, you're talking about your advocacy for other, you know, patients of, you know, that are undergoing treatment, et cetera. So do you feel like your jewelry is giving voice in a way, or in what way is the adversity you've come up against kind of fueled your creativity?
But what I find is women who wear my collection, have always worn my collection, have many, they become very attached to it. And they have many pieces. Some people have 200 pieces of my work and they wear it every day, you know, and it's the kind of thing that I think empowers them to feel. There's so much noise in the world, but I think it's a very like personal thing where they feel that they deserve it. And it, in some cases, it was the first time their first purchase, they ever bought something like that for themselves. And so I feel very honored by that they would choose my work to decide that this is a beautiful thing, that the earth actually has created these little gems for us. It's just, we've put them together, and that these women decide to use that as their thing to feel safe and to feel special. And so back to your question about adversity in my life and how that's helped me through my work is I have a huge belief in human beings and how remarkable they are and how they really can do anything that they put their mind to it. There is no ceiling. And I've always said that. And a lot of people feel like, oh, I can't do this or I can't do this. And I was like, what is the worst thing that can happen is that you fail? Or what's the worst thing that can happen? You have a cancer diagnosis. You're told that the chances are that if you don't do this treatment, that you may not live. And I work with a lot of patients that are so afraid of treatment. And I was like, you still get to choose. So you're given an option. You can choose this. And if you choose to do this, based on research, your chance of survival might be greater than if you don't. So that's a choice. And if you choose to do this, you need to go into it and understand, just like COVID or what's ever happening right now, this is your friend. This is a thing. This is an opportunity to face it straight on in the eye of the storm with every ounce of energy that you have. And if you can't do it, you need to call on somebody to help be your life raft to push you through. Because it is for the people that fight it the most, they have the least favorable outcome, you know? So the adversity for me is it comes out my work in like a really, I think our work is happy. I do. I look at our work. I don't think it's very dark. It's happy.
I think it's very happy, is
joyful. And it's a representation of the good people I have in my life. Who've supported me and taught me, and these incredible cancer patients that I've had a few that literally smiled until their very last breath and said, thank you. And these are people that they didn't wish that upon themselves. And let me tell you, they got up every day and they kept going until they couldn't go any longer, you know? And then there are other people who keep going and their body does not let them down. So I consider it a gift. And so every one of my pieces of jewelry, I'm keeping them with me, bringing light and bringing like beauty to other people. It may sound corny, but that's how I feel.
No, I mean, you're getting me choked up. I grabbed a tissue over just in case before I Skyped you. So no, it's choking me up. And I think, you know, they call it advocacy, what you do with these cancer patients. But I think from what you just said, it's like you're giving them agency. You know, it's easy to just be like, woe is me. And, you know, what can I do? You know, there's nothing I can do. And to be a victim. And it would be totally justified for somebody to feel like 100%. A victim.
You can. And what I tell people, feel like a victim, feel shitty. Today, you can feel shitty. It is your journey. And you can feel shitty and feel pissed for as long as you want. But after that, you can no longer hang on that. You then have to keep saying, I do have choice. And for me to advocate, what I do is I give them choice and I give them a place to be angry and sad. And if they want to let go, they can let go. But also to make choices while they still can. Mm-hmm. And to know that these are choices. It wasn't a choice to have cancer, but whatever, it's not a choice with COVID. It's not, but what do you do with those things? You mm-hmm. know, you can go down this path or you can go down that path. And when I was given the diagnosis, because I've had it a few times, I was like, all right, well, I got to do this. And I trust that I can get the job done. And I mm-hmm. did, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, there were a couple bad days. On those bad days, I watched Locked Up because I was so tired. I couldn't, in the chemo when I went into neutropenia, and I was like, I couldn't even get out. And I was locked up in a room alone. But to this day, I just passed by it on the TV. I was like, no more Locked Up.
You've enough Locked Up.
Right. And that's what I tell the patients. I said, keep everything in a book. Keep all your things, all your pathology, everything in a book, right? And I'll tell you as much as you want to know or as little as you want to know. And then at the end of that chapter of your life, you take that book and you tuck that book away and give it a name. Don't call it Frank. Frank is pissing me off today, so that you can sort of detach with it and not have it be like this circle going around and around in your brain. And so I have actually two patients right now I'm working with through this thing.
That must be really difficult. I mean,
it can be difficult, when it can be difficult, but then other times it's so remarkable. You're like, oh my God, how are you doing this with a smile on your face? And you're at the hospital and you're getting blood transfusions. There's COVID going all around you. And it's like, those are the times when you say, we can prevail. If this person can prevail, we can prevail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and that was, you know, a question that I had for you was if, you know, if you see any correlation between, you know, how you handled the other stages of adversity in your life and, you know, tools that you might have garnered from that, that you're bringing into this stage that we're all facing together. You know, is there advice that you can give others?
I think that the thing that I find with people and what I grew to become more aware of is that today, this moment you and I are having, we don't get this time back. This is it, right? This is our moment. And I'm noticing the books and the cool shape and the on the top of your bookshelf. And I'm seeing that in your lamp. And I'm saying these things really matter to you and how you've like carefully curated your work and your beautiful red lipstick. And these are the things that are important to you and that matter to you. And that today is all we know. Actually, this moment is all we know. And so if you could take one moment a day and just look outside or find a tree or find a leaf or something and just look at how beautiful it is in that moment, if you can have one moment, whether it's 30 seconds or 1 minute or whatever, where you have memory of that and you really pause and try to pay attention to that, then that's really living. Because if you're living out here and you're so afraid that something's going to happen and you're living in fear, then you're like not living because you're not appreciating what just passed you by. I actually think this is Mother Nature's way, big way of saying, screw you guys. I've provided for you the most beautiful sunsets, beautiful green grass for you to take your shoes off and put your feet in, which feels really amazing, by the way, if you have never done it. I did it a lot during chemo and it helps. And like flowers that emerge from like the dirt. And little kids laughing and the funny things they say, or if you just listen to all the birds and the chatter and the things that they're having, they're saying, put your phone down, pay attention to this stuff. Because if you don't, it's gone. So
are you finding that you're even, I mean, it sounds like you're always aware. Are you even more aware now during this period of isolation? I mean, has the, you know, the lack of hustle and bustle in terms of going into your studio and working with your team, has that given you, has that opened up an opportunity for beauty?
I've been working still 12 hours a day because that's what I do. And I've been doing paperwork and I like talk to clients and I'll have like private appointments, trying to take care of my staff, honestly, because they are incredibly important to me. So I'm doing the hustle right now. Most people know that I would say I'm the hustler, you know? And I'm also doing things like trying to reach out, like, can I volunteer somewhere? Can we give back of ourselves during this time? Planning ahead. I reacted very quickly because I went through 2008. And I don't know if Wade shared that with you very early on because I kind of understand human nature. And I was like, every one of our stores is going to be closed. We need to pull back all of our product. I need to plan and hunker down to protect my team because I'm pretty sure that the next 6 weeks, 8 weeks is going to be a shit show. And I know that we're looking a year out before we try to like, before we get back to like what we knew before. And it was one of those moments in life where you realize that history and time benefit you a lot. You know, at 51, because I'd gone through 2008, because I'd gone through cancer, and when I went through cancer, by the way, a single mom with a daughter in college, my son at home with me, and it was right after 2008, there was no business to be had, and I couldn't get unemployment because I was an officer of my company. So it's really like, all right, how am I going to make this little bit of money stretch out over the course of time? So for me, it was like, this is familiar. We can do this. And, and so that's what we've been doing. I've been working still from home. I will say my son is home from college and I'm loving having him home. It's a really gift to me. Miles.
His name, mm-hmm. Miles. Oh, that's awesome.
Miles Bryant, actually, which is my son's middle name.
Okay.
And my grandpa's middle name. And then my Gia, you know, my oldest Gia.
Gia.
Yeah, she's so cute. She's been remarkably supportive to me. And her husband, actually, who's an incredible guy, is actually still working. And he's a biomedical engineer working on the testing equipment and has been for a number of weeks.
Keep going. What does he need?
I know. Exactly. So, but my Miles, my little one, he's not little any longer. He's at school at Columbia in Chicago studying music. And so I got him home and just, I also feel like I said to him the other day, I go, Miles, you know, you can give me an opinion about how things are. I said, I think people like myself now, we really need to look to the young people of the world and of what, how they would do things. Like they really are very collaborative. Mm-hmm. I noticed that in his community, that Z generation, they're very supportive of each other and they co-collaborate. And these are the kind of things that I think we can take lessons from the young people mm-hmm. and like see what they would do to pull us out of it. What is their response level to it? Mm-hmm. This is such a cool time, I think. Actually, it sounds terrible, but it's a great time to see the pioneers.
Mm-hmm.
And pioneers are so inspiring.
Yeah.
You know, there's a restaurant that just opened in my hometown, which I'm really advocating for this town. And if I had time, I'd run for mayor, but I don't have time because I really believe in it. And they opened this spirits place and they make vodka. But of course, nobody's going. And so he's turned the vodka into hand sanitizer.
That's fantastic.
And he is having people wrapped around the building selling hand sanitizer. I mean, that's cool.
That's really cool.
That's
really cool.
You know?
Yeah.
So, of course, we don't want to lose lives at all. This is a tragedy to lose lives in this way. But I think it's forced now the medical community to have more preparation should this happen. And with every crisis, like you said, or every quarantine or anything like that, like never let one of those go to waste because now there's more preparation. Mm-hmm. It's just like 9/11. We got comfortable. People get comfortable. And this is nature's way or whatever, if you're a God person, I don't know, of just kind of reminding you, don't always get too comfortable.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and I keep going back to a quote from Rilke that said, let me not squander the hour of my need. You know, I know that you're, you know, an advocate for, you know, for cancer patients. And also mentorship is a very big part of your brand ethos, correct? I mean, when we asked you to be a mentor during Couture's inaugural mentorship program last year, you did not hesitate. You threw yourself into it and prepared in advance and, you know, you were totally into it. And so is that still a part of, you know,
yes.
Like, you're like nodding, you're nodding enthusiastically.
Yeah. I don't know if it's because I wasn't able to go to college. But then when I worked at university with my company, Angel Studios, and I never stop learning myself. And I mm-hmm. feel like I always have mentors that I look to. And I love working with people who I love being a mentor to them. And I always said, I feel like, you know, people say what success might be to them. To me, it would be like, I'll know that I had success if someone asked me to come teach a class, you know, about good business practices and building a healthy work culture. Because these are the two things that are the two main core pillars of my company. And so to be able to like mentor people who are like at that stage in their career where they're questioning, because I've been through it, where they're questioning, like, should I continue doing this? And what are the reasons that I'm doing this? And what are the sacrifices that I make? And who is my client? You know, and these are things that I learned over time. And I thought to myself, like, if I understood some of these core principles, or like, for example, accounting principles, like I'm mm-hmm. really good at that part. I love that part. But it took a long time for me to understand that, you know?
Yeah.
Once you get that part of it and you figure out what you're willing to sacrifice, who your client is, and why you're doing this, what the principles of your company are, then that gives you like the answers to keep going. You may need to reset those along the way. So if I can help enlighten people that like that's a process that we all go through, even if you've been at it as long as I have. I still feel like I'm brand new at this, by the way, Michelle. Like I still am like, wait, what? Like, I mean, not-
what is it? It's been like 17, 18 years, but
yeah.
Didn't Socrates say that always think yourself the most stupidest or something along those lines? So, yeah.
So, to mentor people is hugely important, and to give back, give of yourself and not mm-hmm. just take. It makes people feel better. And there's a lot of takers in the world and there's a lot of givers. I happen to think there's probably fairly balanced, you know, but it's free for me to give of myself mm-hmm. to someone, you know, or to share something or to offer something. And I also think as a parent, I want to lead by example, because I actively knew when I had children that my goal was for them to feel loved first and foremost. And my second goal was for them to find a purpose for themselves in the world that makes them feel fulfilled, you know? And so how are you going to tell them if you don't show them?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I love to give back. Yeah. I love to give back, and also sometimes just to have that like safe place for someone to say to them without judgment, no competition, of just like, I think this part of your brand is really strong. This might be an area here. I can put you in touch with this person that might make that area stronger. Like, mm-hmm. believe me, I am weak in so many areas, Michelle. And so I have an incredible staff that is strong where I'm weak, you know, like Wade, for example, he loves to do, to go out there and interface and mix and mingle and all that kind of stuff. And then it's actually not a comfort level for me to do that. I feel very shy in those settings. So
okay.
He's a great ambassador of the brand in that way.
Well, yeah, no, that's very smart to hire for what you think of as your weaknesses. You know, I'm wondering about your speculation for a post COVID-19 world, you know, and we all know that, you know, going to the airport after 9/11 looked very different. You know, there's no doubt that the world is going to look different. And one of the things that I have noticed is just, you know, how kind people have been, you know, at a distance, of course. But, you know, you reached out of the blue with an email that brought me to tears. And Wade also emailed and it brought me to tears, just like the kindness. And, you know, every email is starting, you know, I hope you're doing well under this crazy time. You know, is that one of the things, like, what's the new values that are going to be brought into this post COVID-19 world, do you think?
I think that people can't hide anymore. They have to be authentic mm-hmm. and don't do something if you don't really mean it. And authenticity is a value that has gone to the wayside, my personal opinion. From a positive note, I think people are really going to, so the whole world is shifting, right? There's these big boxes and these, someone said to me recently, another designer, that, oh, well, because I wanted to put together a grant for the artisans that do the work, the physical mm-hmm. work. It's not even taught any longer. And she was like, yeah, but people see us as like luxury brands. And I was like, I don't see my brand as a luxury brand. I see like Chanel or something like that. But it's like, I see us as an artisan brand that we are actually employing people as an employer in the United States. We are the American dream of what this country was founded on. And this is something that can't go to the wayside. You know, this is very important. These artisans who work with their hands, we need to, if anything, exploit that now. This time after this needs to not be about me or my brand. It needs about the people who mm-hmm. are the brand. And so I think a more authentic voice will be completely on the table. I think there'll be actually a little less Instagram, because I think it'll be so overpopulated with noise. I think that small retailers actually might have a chance again, because people want the social experience. Mm-hmm. I think that there wasn't a lot of new ideas coming out. And so I think that we need to pay attention to the Z generation that are coming up with new ideas. They are the future of this world. And so I think the overabundance is going to probably sort of go to the wayside, the overabundance, where, mm-hmm. again, more authentic relationships, more authentic product, more authentic values will mm-hmm. be, will surface. Because when somebody's fighting for their life, you know, it's what money is one thing, but when you're fighting for your life and you're suffering, if this isn't a wake up call for people to like really nurture the relationships that they have and something that they've worked hard for and take and not take things for granted, then shame on them, mm-hmm. you know? So mm-hmm. I think post this, it will be a very different world. I do think there needs to be a mix of new, fresh, unique, mixed with like existing talent that that grows and brings in this young talent to help, you know, collaborative. Mm-hmm. So collaboration, I think, is going to be a big thing that comes out of this. Like, we are opening our first jewelry store, retail gallery, which we're very excited about. And it is finished. And we were supposed to open the day that we were told that everybody had to go in.
Yeah, I was going to write about it.
Yeah. So it is a beautiful little gem of a place. It's completely ready. I'm very proud of it. Yes. I say, okay, so here's how I wish people would think. Oh God, this is the worst time. This couldn't have come at a worse time. But you know, it's like, hey, I have a store. Other people don't. We're very lucky in that regard. Mm-hmm. I've sent out to all the any designers that I know or have a good relationship with or that I believe in their work. I've said, you're welcome to come and sell your work. I won't take a dime from it. You can
That's fantastic.
You can put your work in here. And our plan, we're calling it the golden rule, was that if there's a brand that I'm going to carry about 10 to 12 brands.
Okay.
And for the brands, I want them to have a shared value system that I have, but each be unique and different. And we have a project that I'm working on, which I'm calling the golden rule, where the designer gets 70% and the retail gets 30%. And this Wow. is merely to keep the doors open and help support their brand and my brand in kind. And it's not for everybody, but this was one way to try to support them and also like myself and our brand. I'm running a business at the end yeah. of the day. I'm not just an artist. I'm employing 13 people who are incredibly talented people and are not living in LA or New York City or near a jewelry district. Like, they have families and homes and roofs over their house and they need insurance and all that. So that's a big nut for my little company to cover. Mm-hmm. So I'm fair, you know, with my pricing, but I'm also like smart. So in our retail location, I want to be able to do two things. We want to stay in business, one, and two, we want to help create a new voice for my community because I want my community to thrive. I want my community of artists to grow. I feel like there is a good balance. I want to note here, one of the most incredible companies, retailers that I think is Quadrum Gallery. Mm-hmm. And they are such a well-oiled machine. And when this happened, I pulled out of all my accounts, but three. Just very quickly, just to protect our assets. Mm-hmm. But Quadrum was not one of them. They're so respectful to the designer. They're so respectful to the artist's work, the way they package it, the customer service they get, they execute, the fairness in how they do it is really respectful. And I appreciate that. And I wish if all employers had that same level of respect.
So one question that I've been asking throughout these interviews is, you know, we all say that there's no such thing as a jewelry emergency, but you know that there are multiple jewelry emergencies. Can you think of one story that sticks out in your mind where there was a jewelry emergency, so needed something last minute or lost piece or?
Yep. I actually just had one a couple days ago. There's a couple that got married. They secretly got married. She's a widow and she found love after being widowed and being married 25 years, found wow. love. And they together chose to, she was from New Jersey and I forget where he was. I think he was from back east too, but they were living in Miami. He didn't love it. And they together decided, let's move to La Jolla. They don't know anyone out here at all. Just sight unseen, let's start our life out here. And after like COVID, he said, I really want to marry you. And so they looked around and they found one person that had one marriage license left in this county.
Okay.
And so he said to her in the morning, get dressed. We're going somewhere. And she was like, where? She's like, we're going to get married. And she was all dressed in the mat that the officiant was dressed in the mask and the whole nine yards. Well, they didn't even have rings. He went to Walmart and got like fake rings. So she reached out to me and she said, can I get an emerald, whatever, diamond? And I was like, you know, that might be impossible right now. But so anyway, we provided for her. So she has, we delivered it yesterday. So she has a little ring on her finger that we did. Actually, it was Jenny Kwan's ring, which is okay. pretty cool. Maybe carrying her cool. work. Very cute. Yep. And we delivered that ring to her and it was absolutely a jewelry emergency. And to them, a very meaningful vessel of how important they are to each other. So I do think there are jewelry emergencies for sure.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, I could literally sit here and chat with you all day, but I'm going to sign off now on the recording. So thank you so much.
Michelle, it was so great spending time with you today. And I look forward to what our bright future is ahead.
Thank you for listening to the Couture Podcast. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts.